Hi. Okay, sorry for that delay. I'll just keep you late at the other end. Okay, I won't. Reminder, review session here, Friday, same time as class, but here. Voluntary, no attendance taken. And the format will be whatever questions you have and a few little exercises that I will put together to guide our thinking about getting ready for the eco exam, which is on Monday in class here. No, you do not need to bring a number two pencil on Monday. You may if you want, but you may take the exam in ink or pencil, anything but not red. No red pen. That's ours. Okay. If you use red pen, it confuses us and we start using your paper as the key and then we're all messed up. Okay, other news. Tonight at 6, how many of you are planning to attend the Human Development and Family Studies career discussion tonight? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. We'll have plenty of refreshments then. Question?
What is the format of the eco exam?
Fill in the blanks, match, short answer, identify things. It's very objective, very straightforward.
Do you want to like, be hypothesis
number? No. No. The guide in the syllabus for expectations says, no, the general principles of the hypotheses, but I won't ask you to identify them by number. I happen to know a few of them by number, but only because I've been using them for 15 years. So, no. Everything you need to know, you will know, or you know, it'll be fairly straightforward. No. Short answer, at most. You know, it's a little hard to write an essay on the stuff that you know, as you know it so far. It's really pretty objective. We want to be able to grade it quickly, and we just want to know if you know the stuff. Can you identify the basic concepts? Can you apply them? Can you pick out a molar activity when you see a short description of something? Can you tell whether it's molar or not? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Yeah,
more.
Length? I don't know. 5 pages? It'll take you 37 minutes. Don't prove me wrong. Okay, it won't take the whole period for most of you, and there's nobody in here after class, so there's no limit. So don't worry about it. But if you have a class after this one, it won't be a problem. Yeah, how long is it? It's 5 or 6 pages, I guess, but. And how many questions? Well, you know, one question may have 8 or 10 parts. The first question covers a whole page and it has about 10 parts. And it takes you about 2 minutes to do it. It's just a list of the definitions. And then match them to the words they define. I'm really talking simple here. It's very simple. Just to make sure that you've read the book, you know the book, you've got the stuff in your head enough to be able to use it as we go on. Now, because then we're going to have the fun of applying it to families. Okay? Enough on that. Wednesday, Friday, Monday. Plan B. If you have seen the weather forecast for Friday, we're already getting warnings that some people may have trouble getting here. If it turns out worse than they're predicting, and you really do have difficulty getting here, with enough requests by email, I would schedule a review on Sunday afternoon. But only if I get email requests to do that, and enough to make it worthwhile, because if I do that on a Sunday afternoon, it costs, right? I have to make it up to my wife. That's the, so, you know, a new pair of shoes, something like that. Tiffany.
What time is
that?
Well,
what time is the afternoon on that? 3 o'clock. Pick one. Is that, I didn't hear any groans. You're all expecting to be here Friday, and this is Vermont. You know how to do that, so. Okay. If we end up scheduling a substitute or an emergency one for Sunday, I will email the entire class and announce that and put it on the website. Questions at this point? Exercise 3 is here in random order. You may pick yours up. Talia.
You just said that I had gotten a couple emails asking for information on Final 4, so
I can read your mind. Okay. I think, let's see, I probably should go back to the did I put anything else up here that isn't on the board? That's touchy. Stop that. Ah, I did. Criteria. Oh, same thing. All right. So, what we're expecting is that you'll cover completely all of those concepts or points if you can accurately identify and interpret the components and explain them to us. So, it's not a dash it off the night before. You can do it the night before, but you need to spend a long time, and you need to write it carefully, and you need to revise it, and you need to proofread it before you turn it in. Talia says you need to proofread it and get somebody else to read it. Okay? That's due Wednesday. So now we've covered tonight and Friday and maybe Sunday and next Monday and next Wednesday, and after that we should take a week off, I think. Okay. So, be my guest. Week of the 12th, we will not have class. Brightness up. Zoom in. That's what we're talking about, the macro system. And what is it? Again, it's the way things hang together and are consistent across microsystems, including the roles, relations, and activities, the way settings are structured, the way the mesosystem is connected, what kinds of settings there are in the mesosystem, how things are done in the exosystem, and all of those consistencies, and the beliefs, the views of the world that underlie them. It's essentially referring to what we call culture or subculture. So, questions or examples? The two examples that are described in the book are fairly, I think, fairly easy examples for people in this macro system, and they are probably so familiar and so embedded in the macro system that most of us share that we don't even think of them. So it's hard to think how they might represent a macro system. But the point that I make in the book is that you can move from town to town in the United States and you'll find a school. And you will not be surprised if that school is divided into kindergarten and first through fourth grade, or fifth or sixth or eighth, something like that. And then there may be another building that is called a middle school, and it'll cover 4th through 8th, or 5 through 8, or 6 through 8, or 9, and we're used to having something in the middle. And then there'll be another building that's a high school, and you will expect that those will be organized differently. You will expect that the microsystem within the setting of the elementary school is that most kids spend most of the day with one teacher in a particular classroom. And then when they get to high school, they will have periods. They are post-pubescent, and some of the students will be having periods, but the school day will be divided into periods, and students will move from room to room, the teachers will stay in the room, and the typical teacher will have 5 classes a day or 4, see 100 students, not really know any of them except by reputation. And you're all familiar with that. And each period will be 37 minutes long, 43 minutes long. Some stupid number that allows what somebody has figured out is the appropriate time for students to get from one room to the next and fill the day from the time the buses get there until the buses leave before after-school activities. So it wouldn't surprise you if you walked into it or drove into a town and that's the way things were arranged, right? It would surprise you if you drove into a fairly sizable community and you didn't find a school and children were not being transported to another town for school. It would surprise you, wouldn't it? In the United States, if you went into a community and there was no school system. If it would surprise you if things were different, then that is a macro system feature. And the organization of the school is a macro system feature. It's consistent across the entire United States. It would not surprise you in any school to find that they have a series of graded levels of science textbooks. You would expect that. It would not surprise you to find that the year was divided into 4 or 6 segments, and I don't know what they call them in schools anymore. A quarter, if it's divided into 4. Marking period. That's right. I knew that. There was a word. Marking. And what happens in the marking period? At the end of the marking period? A progress report goes home. And would it surprise you if it had letters on it? A, B, C, D, E. Yeah. Why? Do we want We want to figure out whether the teacher is competent. Right? That's why we give grades, so we'll know if the teacher is succeeding. And if she's not, we fire her if her students do not make adequate progress. Okay, maybe I'm a little outside the macro system. Maybe we don't fire them. Maybe we think we're grading students, not teachers. There's a whole set of beliefs about accountability and tests and assessment and marking and reporting those progresses to parents, and teachers have to sign their names and parents have to sign their names and indicate that they got them. That's all supported by a set of beliefs, most of them basically erroneous, but they're beliefs anyway about learning and development and getting our money's worth out of the enormous expenditure of schools that we place in schools. Okay? The other example is the notion of a representational democracy. And what it says in the book is that we've bought into that. We bought into that at some point, in 1775, probably, when we said, King George, we aren't going to pay you taxes anymore, and we're going to set up a democracy, and we're going to vote for our leaders, and we're going to, I think, it was it 1781, when we decided to limit the number of the length of the presidency. Anyway, we're going to do it this way. And every white man is going to get one vote. And 175 years from now, we will, or 150 years from now, we will allow white women to vote. And somewhere along the way, maybe we'll, we're not going to let blacks vote unless they're free. But okay. We have this notion that people should choose their leaders and they should be able to unchoose them. And when we make a decision, we're going to gather the people together and we're going to vote on it. And if there are too many people spread across too large an area, like a state, we're going to have them elect people to represent them in a smaller deliberative body which will represent them and make rules, make laws, pass laws. And we have a set of beliefs that underlie that consistency. All of our states, most of our communities, many of our institutions are governed in that way, in such a fashion that when we go into a group of people, you know, parent-teacher group at school, or a neighborhood group, if somebody comes in and starts trying to make decisions for us and tell us what we're all going to do, we have a gut reaction to that. And somebody will eventually say, well, wait a minute, I think we should vote on this. And everybody rallies around that and says, oh, yeah, right, yeah. What they're doing is representing, they're manifesting their participation in the macro system feature of voting to make decisions. And the majority rules. And nobody questions it. So we do it. Sometimes we'll have a group that will decide to operate by consensus rather than by voting. Consensus means everybody in the group is going to agree. And we're going to talk something through until we all agree on what we should do. That's a wonderful way to run a small group. If the members of the small group have an enormous amount of time, and if they have good discussion skills, and if they can, in fact, all come to agreement. But it takes an enormous amount of time and energy. So it's rare that we find that, particularly in larger organizations. So we buy into this set of beliefs that we should all be represented, everybody should have a vote. If you're not at the meeting, well, maybe we should use a mail-in ballot so that everybody gets to vote on decisions that influence them. And if they choose not to, that's their right. they don't have to participate, and then the majority of those voting will make the decisions. You are aware that in some cultures, in some settings, that's not the way things are done. Voting is mandatory in many countries. We get 45-50% of people out in a presidential election. They get 98%, and if you have a doctor's excuse, you don't have to vote. But they get everybody because it's mandatory. That's different. Other countries, they make decisions by having the king or the dictator or whoever, the emperor, say, this is what we're going to do. If you don't like it, off with your head. That's a different macro system. It's a different way of doing things, and it's one that we, in fact, rebelled against. So the values that we use to justify our representational democracy were important enough to us to throw out the king and put ourselves in harm's way to chase his soldiers out. And we did. We treated them nicely when they surrendered at Yorktown, but nevertheless, we shipped them off home. Other examples or questions about the use of the term macro system? The macro system refers to, the question is the relationship between the phrase macro system features and the word macro system. Features refers to those components that we use to say this is the macro system. It's just, we're going to specify, rather than saying we have a macro system here, we're going to talk about its features in order to define it and understand how it operates. Other questions about the use? Would you recognize a macro system if you tripped over one? Probably. Mostly, it would strike you as being different if it were not part of this macro system, if it were not a feature of the macro system that you're familiar with and comfortable in. When you run into something that is representative of some other macro system, it strikes you as foreign. It strikes you as strange. Why do they do this? That's odd. Yeah. So, growing up in a small community in Illinois, random example, small community in Illinois where the only religion represented among the residents, 2,400 of us, was Christian. And there weren't anybody else there. So it was unlikely that you would run into any feature of Judaism or any other religion other than Christianity. And it was fascinating to me when I was in college. I worked for the summer in an organization, in an institution for children that was funded and supported and run by B'nai B'rith. And sitting down for dinner involved saying, I don't know whether it's the equivalent of grace, but you know, as we did at home, we said grace. I don't remember who she was, but we said a prayer over the meal and thanked God for it. And at Belfair, it was in Hebrew, and I didn't know it. Not only did I not know it, I didn't understand it. And they tried to teach it to me by rote, which was very funny. And then there were a number of other things that happened. You know, the staff didn't go to church on Sunday morning. They went to services on Friday night. Odd. Strange. Why would they do that? I was running into a macro system which was consistent with Judaism. And it was foreign to me because I had never encountered it before. Okay. That consistency is similar because, you know, we can even put the phrase together Judeo-Christian. We can hyphenate it and make one word. We can talk about the Old and New Testaments and all of those religions except the Muslims that came out of the Middle East with a belief in one God. So those are consistent, but there are significant differences among them in the way they do things. The traditions are part of the macro system. What is a tradition? Right. A tradition is a set of activities. Of activities and perhaps roles that are part of the consistency in the macro system. I'm sorry, say it again, louder, just because I didn't hear. Right. We say the Pledge of Allegiance. Other countries do the same thing, often in different languages and facing different flags. It's not an American tradition. Pledging your allegiance is a tradition in many cultures. In some it's required. Here it's constitutionally protected, so you're not required to stand up in school and say the Pledge of Allegiance. And even if you do, you may leave out the words under God if you choose. So we have some flexibility there. But pledging your allegiance is an activity that represents your relationship to the authority of whatever system you're in. So you may need to pledge your allegiance to the state of Vermont, for example. How many of you vote in Vermont? How many of you are registered to vote? Did you have to take the Freeman's Oath? That is a pledge of allegiance to the state, and it is a claim that your vote is free. I've forgotten the words now, but because it's been so long ago. I will vote my conscience without influence or pressure by anybody else. I will not sell my vote. I am a free man, and I will vote freely. And that's a holdover from way back. And Vermont, as far as I know, is the only state that still uses one. But the traditions like that, that we associate with, for example, America, with the Pledge of Allegiance, often have similarities in other countries around the world because we don't invent the wheel, we plagiarize it from other places, modify it to make it ours, and modifying it to make it ours means to make it more consistent with the macro system and the beliefs that we have. Christmas and Christmas celebrations and the traditions around those are an outgrowth of the melding, actually, of several macro systems, including Christianity and Scandinavian traditions of midwinter celebrations. And you know, we've created the stories around it that, you know, the wise men showed up with gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but not a Christmas tree and not bubble lights. Those are things that we have added. Why did we add bubble lights and electric bulbs? Because putting candles on your tree is a way to burn your house down. It used to be done fairly regularly. So you lit your tree, you had your bucket in your hand, and you lit your tree and you left the candles burn for 15 minutes, and that was Christmas. Now we can put them on in October, leave them on until the snow melts. I know three people who have Christmas trees in their living room year-round, artificial trees. Lighted. Yeah. They've taken the tradition. They're out of my macro system. They've taken the tradition way out there. But all of the things that we think of as ritual activities, as traditional activities, that are done by a particular group of people, whether it's a small group or a very large group, reflect the features of that macro system. Okay. Saying rabbit, rabbit tomorrow morning. 1st of March tomorrow, right? First thing is a rabbit, rabbit. That's part of the macro system for some of you. We're going to make it the macro system in this class. If you say rabbit, rabbit tomorrow morning, it's the very first thing you say before you say anything to anybody else, you are almost guaranteed to pass the eco exam on Monday. That would be a belief underlying a superstitious behavior. Okay. For Bronfenbrenner, the notion of macro system accomplishes a couple of things. One is it allows us to ask about culture by saying, if we participate in a culture, we can call it a macro system, we can specify what that means by identifying the nature of the settings, the nature of the roles, relationships, and activities, how microsystems are set up, how settings relate to each other, how things are done in that culture or in that subculture. And connecting that to development, then we understand the influence of culture to be through those consistencies to the individual and the proximal processes that the person is engaged in those settings, in those relationships, doing those activities, in those roles, in those microsystems. So as we grow up, we are inevitably encountering the macro system. We're not calling it that, but we're engaged in roles, relationships, and activities which are consistent with other roles, relationships, and activities within that macro system. So it is creating the proximal processes we're engaging in are creating a repertoire of activities, roles, and relationships, and a way of understanding the world, which is our development, that is being shaped by those consistencies and making it possible for us to communicate with and understand and relate to other people who share that macro system. Okay. So that's its purpose. So that when I say, well, that's because he grew up in the Midwest, I can make the connection between the roles, relationships, and activities that are typical in households in the Midwest and the belief systems that underlie them and what I see that person doing now. And if I can't make those connections, then I don't have any business saying that's because he grew up in the Midwest. I shouldn't say it. Okay. So that's the bottom line for macro system. We carry our macro system with us in the set of expectations that we have, the view of the world we have, and the skills we have for dealing with it. So we carry that with us, so when we enter a new setting, we have a set of expectations that setting, assuming that it's part of our macro system, will have particular features in it. It will be run in particular ways. If we know we're going to another culture, we're going someplace where we've never been before and we know they do things differently, then we go into that setting looking for the differences. And we go into that setting and they do things differently here. They have raw fish for breakfast. Gag me. Yeah. And I'm not going to be able to find my Cheerios. They're not going to sell them in the store. And I haven't figured out how to make my own. How do you make your own Cheerios? So I'm going to eat what they put in front of me, even if it's raw fish, pickled fish. But that's what they do. And you go to Scotland and they'll give you haggis. You go to the south here, they give you grits. How many of you can't start your day without a good serving of grits? You know what grits are. You go to Denny's, you can get grits. It's a Southern corporation. And they want to make Southerners feel comfortable here. How many of you know what grits are? Okay. What are they? What's the basic ingredient in grits? You've eaten them, or you've left them on your plate. Grits are made from corn. The corn. They are a misuse of the kernel of corn. Corn should be made into bourbon. That's what corn is for. Or gasohol. But what they do with the corn is they remove the kernel where all the nutritional value is. They take the kernel out and they do something else with that. They make cornmeal. They take what's left, which is basically worthless, and they soak it in lye. And the lye bleaches it so that it's white and breaks it down chemically, and then they rinse it, and then they boil it, and then they put it on your plate. And it provides some bulk. And if you put enough butter or syrup on it, it provides some carbohydrates. But, okay, enough. Do I sound prejudiced against grits? Yes, I do. Sorry. On the other hand, chitlins, go for it. Okay.
So, like, the South, like, having the culture of grits would be a whole different macro system as opposed to, like, Northern aspects? Like,
The question is whether having grits would make it a whole different macro system.
Well, not only that, but, like, the whole thing involved.
The cuisine and the use of indigenous foods would be a feature of a macrosystem difference. So regional differences in food would represent differences in some aspects of the macrosystem.
Could say you want to divide North and South into like they're two separate macrosystems, but they could be part of the same macrosystem. You know what I mean? Like
mm-hmm.
we have plenty of yep. things that we share in common, but there are certain right. differentiating features.
Yeah. The key there is that you would be looking at regional differences within the macro system, and you would be deciding whether or not you wanted to call it sufficiently different that it would be a different macro system. And I wouldn't want to make those distinctions on the basis of whether or not you serve grits.
Yeah.
But what you would expect to find is that the macro system will reflect particularly in the physical features, it will reflect the natural resources that are available in a particular region. So the nature of your physical structures, for example, is part of the culture, and that will reflect the resources that you have to make dwellings out of. And if you don't have much lumber, you know, you're out in the Southwest, you're going to find a lot of adobe. Because you do have a lot of mud, and you have water, and you have straw, and so you can make adobe. In other places, you have thatched roofs, because that's what you have access to, and it makes a pretty good roof. Just don't smoke in the attic. But Bronfenbrenner doesn't address how many features have to be different or what the really important features are to create a macrosystem difference. So it's a fuzzy concept at best. It's a useful concept in that when we talk about cultural differences and people developing differently in different cultures or subcultures, or we want to talk about the influence of growing up in a particular subculture, the notion of macrosystem challenges us to try to define the proximal processes and the roles and the relationships and activities that are typical of that subculture, because they are what are going to be influencing your development. You're not growing up in the American macro system if you're not participating in some of the key features of that macro system. So for us to say you're an American and you've developed as an American assumes that you have learned certain ways of putting things together in your ecosystem. And we should be able to define those.
I'm having a ton of questions.
That's right. When they ban you, when they want to vote you off.
Is there like a distinction between mental differences and physical differences? I know we're talking like food, like crops, but then mm-hmm. what about the enhanced racist beliefs of the South as opposed to the North?
In looking at, for example, and I don't want to insult Southerners or get into a North-South debate, but one of the characteristics of the Southern states is that kids tend to grow up with a different view of the Civil War than we typically teach in Northern states, and with a fondness and a sentimental fondness for the Confederacy. Often without much understanding of what the Confederacy stood for and why it was fighting to secede from the rest of us. And in the North we get our view of that. So what you find in the South is a different view of the Civil War and its winners and losers and its heroes. And you participate in learning about those, and you participate in learning some activities that reflect that historical carryover, just as we do in the North. The difference is that we won, and therefore they're not a separate country. And they still see themselves as sometimes still fighting that battle. But we won. Okay. The last concept in the book, we're not actually going to spend any time on at all except for about the next 2 minutes. And that's the notion of chronosystem. I'm not sure why Bronfenbrenner added the notion of chronosystem, but essentially what he's referring to is the fact that things change over time. And this was not in his original work in 1979. He added it. And did it as a way of being able to talk about change or consistency in the environments that you live in. So he wanted to be able to encompass historic change. And the fact that growing up in a particular macro system, particularly, macro systems change, societies change, communities change, schools change. And he wanted to draw our attention to the necessity to look at how an ecosystem has changed rather than run the risk of assuming that the ecosystem is stable and the person is passing through its settings. And we're not going to wrestle with it, except occasionally I may say something like this might have been different in 1970 compared to 2005. If I'm looking at research, it's important for me to keep in mind that ecosystems change over time. So, for example, if I'm looking at relationships within the family, in 1955, and I'm looking at husband-wife relationships, And I'm looking at the sexual relationship and the sexual activity of a couple in 1955. It will help me to understand how the ecosystem was different in 1955. And the ecosystem was different because in 1955 there were no birth control pills. There were no vasectomies, tubal ligations, or legal abortions. And that feature of the ecosystem dictated some of the characteristics of spousal relationships within a marriage, in any relationship, but particularly in the marital relationship. If I look at the same variables in 2000 or 1995, it is necessary, as I look at the couple relationships changing, and they certainly have since 1955, as I look at that change, it's going to be useful for me to think about, have couples changed or has the environment changed? And that's a chicken and egg question. Bronfenbrenner's approach to that would be to say, well, we have here the function of the chronosystem. The ecosystem has changed because of the advent of female-controlled birth control, contraception, female-controlled contraception, and therefore a change in the male-female relationship in the sexual relationship within the family. And we need to understand the change in the ecosystem in order to understand the change in couple relationships. So that's why he threw it in, because he wanted to call our attention to the fact that you don't step in the same river twice. Because the river keeps flowing. The river in this case is time, and time includes changes of a technological sort, of a social sort, a war, economy. All of those changes influence the way the ecosystem functions, the way the whole ecosystem functions. So whether, if you're looking, for example, at behavior in families, parenting behavior, and their expectations for adolescents during the Great Depression, they're fairly unique in the Great Depression because families were stressed financially. So parents had different expectations of their adolescents than we typically do now. Okay. But that's because of economic differences, and those represent the function of the chronosystem. Okay. So that's about all we need to say. We'll keep coming back to it. I'm not going to focus on it at all. Okay. What do you need to know for the eco exam? This is from the syllabus. So what we're trying to do in these 5 or 6 weeks is to learn a set of concepts: role, dyad, activity, relation, affect, reciprocity, power, all of the concepts that you ought to be able to define, and how they're related to each other. So that we can apply them to understand development. The relationship between your transactions in the environment and your development. That's the goal. So we're going back to the very title of the course. This is the family context of development. We haven't gotten to family much yet, but we're talking about the context and how to understand it. So with this unit behind us, we'll be able to look at families and think about them as context for development, because we'll be able to think about the roles, relationships, and activities, the microsystem that they create in a particular setting, the affect, power, and reciprocity in each of the dyadic relationships within the family, et cetera, et cetera, and what kind of molar activities they engage in. So you should know the basic definitions. You should at least be able to recognize them. And so if you encounter in writing on the first page of the eco exam Bronfenbrenner's definition for mesosystem, you should recognize that that is the definition for mesosystem and be able to distinguish that from the definition for macrosystem or microsystem or exosystem or setting or dyad or role. Okay. They'll just be listed there. You get to match them up with what they define. The hypotheses, again, the gist of them, not by number. How you might use them or apply them in interpreting any particular event. You should be able to think about the connections between the activities you engage in and development, and the relations you engage in and development. So what conditions of activities are important? What kinds of activities are important in your development? Why does it matter what kinds of activities you're engaging in? You should recognize the types of dyads. And you should be able to answer these questions. The difference between this overhead and the syllabus is that on the syllabus they're not numbered. That's what I accomplished today. I numbered them. Okay. It's the little things in life. Yeah. So, what's important about the dyadic relationships? Where do you want the power to be going? If you wanted to make a relationship more or less developmentally facilitating, how would you change it? And in this case, how would... Just fascinated by the thought of what would have happened if I had not caught myself, and whether I would have broken my ankle or my knee. But we might have had an abrupt end to the class. Or I would have stood here in major pain and I would have continued until quarter till, because I'm so devoted and dedicated to making sure you were ready for the eco exam. Then I would have arrived in class or the review session in my wheelchair. Okay. So if you're thinking about how to make something more developmentally facilitating, in this case, what you don't want to say is make the people love each other more. Or give mom more money. What you want to be able to do when you think about a relationship being developmentally facilitating is to think about what? The dyadic relationship.
Yourself,
I'm sorry?
Yourself, not
yeah, but what about yourself? What characteristics? Power, reciprocity, positive affect. What else?
Put yourself in a different setting that's either conducive or not conducive to growth. Well, or you could take that relationship into new settings that are conducive to growth.
Aha! Make it a transcontextual dyad. Take it into other settings, shared settings with the people who are in it. Okay. What about the activities that it engages in? Bronfenbrenner is very specific. Make them become more complex. Make them become more reciprocal, which is saying increase the reciprocity in a slightly different way, make the activities more reciprocal. Okay, so it's looking at the relationship between the activities and the development, and then how do you think about the activities within the relationship? Okay. So you want to go through the book and think about the hypotheses as if they were true. We have to kind of accept them for a bit and think about the characteristics of dyads as they're being thought about in those hypotheses that apply to making it more or less developmentally facilitating. What characteristics of roles affect a person's development? It's a badly worded question, so I'll change it next year. The characteristics, the role of a role in your development is whether or not the roles that you interact with are complex and structurally different. Do you get to interact with people who are in a variety of different sorts of roles? And there are two ways to read that, and both are accurate. One is, I get to interact with a lot of people who are in different roles. So I get to see the doctor, I get to see the dentist, I get to see the hygienist, I get to see the physical therapist, I get to see the hospital administrator, I get to see the child life specialist, I get to see the pediatric nurse, I get to see the psychiatrist. All those roles are different. And as a child or as a developing person, if I get to interact with all of those people, that's going to be good for my development, assuming they're not completely overwhelming me. The other way to read it is that I need to see, or I'm helped by seeing, interacting with people who occupy, a person who occupies a variety of roles. So it would help me in my development as a child, hypothetically, if I see my mother being a mother, and I see her being a spouse, and I see her being a daughter, I see her being a sister, I see her being a breadwinner, I see her being a volunteer, I see her being a smart person, I see her being a musician, I see her contributing to the school, I see her raising money for whatever, I see her as a volunteer fire person, then I'm interacting with her in a way that lets me see that she can do lots of different things. That's probably giving me the notion that one person is not stuck in a particular role. And the other thing is that because she's my mother, I'm getting a sense of how many different sorts of things she can do, which is going to make me impressed and respect her. But it also means that she has a lot of things to teach me about. She has a lot of things to do with me. She has a lot of settings in which to take me. She has a lot of settings in which to engage in primary dyadic relationships with other people, with me, and those people are going to create a rich mesosystem for me. And because these people from all over town know my mother, they're going to provide opportunities for me, they're going to engage me in activities, they're going to know me. I'm not going to want for social connections and support in my community, because my mother, of whom I'm very fond, at 4, 5, 8, 10, 12, I'm fond of mine now anyway. But what I'm going to do with that fondness is I'm going to participate in her rich mesosystem. And that's going to be good for my development. Contrast that to a kid who has a parent who is at home all the time, doesn't do anything outside, doesn't engage in any activities, what am I learning? What am I getting? What's that doing to my mesosystem? What is that parent who has no other roles able to engage me in activities, in relationships, in settings? Okay. So you can read the notion of roles as good for development if you get to interact with lots of different people in different roles, and if you get to interact with some people who occupy a variety of roles, single person who occupies a variety. And then the last feature that's important about roles is that, do I get to play them? Do I get to do a variety of things? Do I get to engage in the reciprocal roles, the complementary roles, in a lot of different settings? That's going to teach me to understand the world and have a bigger repertoire of molar activities than I would have if I don't. Okay? Is that hanging together? How do settings affect development? There you are in a setting. There you sit. What would be good for you in that setting? Multiple roles, multiple molar activities, a changing environment, increasing complexity, and in addition to the roles in the setting, what else might there be? Dyads, and what would be good about those for me? Right, a high level of reciprocity, high positive affect, a balance of power that's gradually moving in my direction. Yes! Lots of primary dyadic relationships, lots of people who love me. So I come to class every day. I have all this power and I have all these people who love me. And, you know. So we have roles, and we have dyads, and you already covered the activities. So a setting would be nice if it was a rich environment with positive affect and all of those sorts of things. And if you wanted to make a setting less developmentally facilitating, what would you do to it? Less developmentally facilitating. And you're in charge of the setting. What do? This is the evil developmentologist at work. You want to make it less developmentally facilitating. Reduce the number of activities, isolate the person, take the interesting people away. It's called solitary confinement. And it's not very good for your development. It's isolation, social isolation. Yeah. Repetitive behaviors. Yeah. Nothing that gets more complex. Nothing interesting. And what happens when you put people in those kinds of situations, or chimpanzees, or your dog? They go insane eventually, but they start inventing activities. Head banging, nail chewing, self-mutilation, hair pulling, all those sorts of things that kids do when you put them in isolated situations. You know, eating their own feces, all kinds of interesting stuff, writing on the walls with their feces. You know. So you got to do something. So you do things, you know, pull your toenails out or whatever, pull your hair out. monkeys do that, people do that, when you put them in settings that are bad for their development. The mesosystem, the connection between mesosystem and development. When you think about mesosystem, what do you want it to be? Flirt, loudly. Yeah, but the mesosystem specifically is the relationships among the settings. So how do you want them to relate? And if they're going to play off each other, what's going to have to happen? Play off of each other is not a Brontë-Mernerian term. Intersetting knowledge. Connection. Transcontextual dyads. Goal consensus. All of those are features of the mesosystem that are good for you. You want to go into the setting, into a new setting, when you add it to your mesosystem. You want to go into it with people you already have primary dyadic relationships with and have participated in previous settings. And ideally, you'll go into those new settings with somebody you already have a primary dyadic relationship with. And in that new setting, that person will already have a primary dyadic relationship. So you come into a setting where the other person has friends. Okay. So you're talking about how to make it more connected and interconnected. And if you can do that, then you're making it, hypothetically, better for the developing person, the more richly it is connected. Okay? Piece of cake. And it's fun, too. Thank you. I'll see some of you on Wednesday.